Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With 2 weeks to go before the November 4th midterm elections, we'll begin with an analysis of the critical Senate races that will be determine the fate of the remainder of Obama's presidency. Democratic strategist Ed Kilgore, the principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog, who was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, joins us to discuss the recent shift in the polls in favor of Republicans that make it more and more unlikely the Democrats will retain the Senate, particularly with fear-mongering driving Republicans to the polls, while apathy and indifference on the Democratic side usually makes turnout low for them in midterms. Then we'll examine the epidemic of unreasonable fear and irrational paranoia sweeping the land following the contraction of Ebola by two healthcare workers in Texas. Barry Glassner, a professor of sociology at Lewis and Clark College in Oregon and author of the award-winning book, The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things, joins us to discuss why, according to recent polls, almost 50% of Americans believe they are at risk of contracting Ebola and how much exaggerated fears drummed up by Republican politicians of porous borders allowing Ebola and the Islamic State to spread across the land are likely to drive voters to the polls. Then finally, we'll speak with Sung-Yoon Lee, a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University and an associate in research at the Korean Institute at Harvard University, about the release of one of three Americans held captive in North Korea and examine the possible reasons why North Korea's young leader has been absent from view as speculation over his health has prompted fears for false rumors of a coup when it might just be that Kim Jong-un has gout as a result of eating too much rich food in a country where people are starving. Joining us now is Ed Kilgore, who's the principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He is also the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn and a federal state relations staffer for three governors of Georgia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ed Kilgore.
Thanks a lot, Ian.
And I'd like to get a sense, since we're only 2 weeks away from the November 4th midterm elections, where Democrats normally don't show up in large numbers, and Republicans do. This has prompted President Obama to say some months back that Democrats almost have a genetic problem about voting in midterms. But for a while there, it looked like the Democrats might hold on to the Senate. It also looked that there might be a couple of surprise upsets, particularly in Kansas being in play. But I understand that in the last week or so, things have turned away from the hope that Democrats might had, and that the Republicans now are feeling less panicked and more assured. Is that a reasonable analysis?
Well, it's reasonable, though it's still, believe it or not, a little bit early to make any kind of conclusions. I think I would start by observing that it was always going to be a long shot for Democrats to hold on the Senate. It's just been an insanely favorable landscape for Republicans. A second-term midterm election in which the president's party almost always loses seats in Congress, a midterm election where, as you alluded to, a Democratic Party that's now increasingly dependent on younger and minority voters who just rarely ever turn up proportionally in midterms, and then a sort of plague of frogs of international incidents that's sort of overshadowed what was supposed to be a domestically determined election. So in terms of the landscape, there are, in this midterm, eight Democratic senators running for re-election in states carried by Mitt Romney, which is maybe the worst landscape I think any party has ever faced in a midterm election. And with Republicans only needing six seats to take back the Senate, I personally have felt all along that the odds were pretty high they would succeed.
Well, in terms of the plague of frogs, you would think from the media that the United States was under attack from the Islamic State, and Ebola was spreading across the land and being brought in by Mexicans climbing over the border.
Yeah, right.
I mean, how's that playing? I know that Scott Brown had to kind of edit out some of the more salacious stuff in his ads up in New Hampshire, where he actually, I think the family of the executed American journalist Foley objected to the use of him, their son being beheaded on videotape in Scott Brown's TV advertising. So, and I think it's the fellow down in Cotton, down in Arkansas, is also beating the drum on, I think, conflating the idea that Mexicans crossing the border are bringing in both Ebola and perhaps Islamic State fighters. So the whole thing is taking on a kind of absurdity. Where is the adult standing up against this kind of stuff?
Well, the president's trying to. But again, these tactics by Republican candidates are, a lot of them really harken back to the 2002 election, a midterm election where the incumbent party did gain seats, and Republicans took away from that the belief that if you could frighten, particularly women, you know, who have recently been leaning Democratic in most elections, if you could frighten them with national security concerns, you might produce a very different outcome. You know, that 2002 was the supposed security moms election. So, frankly, Republicans are always willing to use fears associated with the border and with national security and terrorism to their advantage. And several of them are doing so pretty actively right now. As whether it's going to matter, it's not entirely clear. I think maybe by Election Day, the Ebola scare may have subsided a little bit. But without question, Republicans are trying to use that to reinforce perceptions that the country's out of control and that the president and Democrats can no longer manage it.
Again, I'm speaking with Ed Kilgore, who's a principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He's also the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn and a federal state relations staffer for three governors of Georgia. Now, in terms of what looked like a possible pickup on the part of the Democrats, a surprise one in Kansas, the reddest of all the red states, I believe that Pat Roberts is making a bit of a turnaround, the incumbent Republican who was endangered by an independent. And I believe also that the Koch brothers, Kansas City-based Koch brothers, worth, I think, about $100 billion between them, are pouring in some substantial funds. So has that changed things, the money?
Well, possibly. It's a little early to say. But, yeah, Kansas has been fascinating. This is one of the most Republican states in the country, where there's been actually a pretty explicit backlash against right-wing Governor Sam Brownback, who's conducted a purge of moderate Republicans in state elections. And it's spilled over into the Senate race, where an independent candidate, who's now being backed by Democrats, has been leading Pat Roberts in the polls. This has created a panic attack by national Republicans and the Koch brothers, who are pouring resources into the state to save Roberts and Brownback. And it's not entirely clear how it's going to turn out, but certainly this sort of threat to the flanks of the Republican Party there, and also in South Dakota, where a former Republican Senator Larry Pressler has been looking impressive as a third-party candidate on the ballot, have gotten the attention of Republican funders. So they're going to be seeing a lot of attack ads in both those states against the independent candidates.
But what's interesting about these races in South Dakota and Kansas, I understand, Ed Kilgore, is that neither Pressler or the independent candidate in Kansas have said whether they'll caucus with the Democrats or the Republicans. They seem to be keeping their powder dry so that whoever wins the Senate they probably go with, you know, the majority. Obviously, you know, there's no fun being in the minority. So that could get pretty interesting, couldn't it? I mean, if
there are actually four different contests that could cast control of the Senate in doubt on election night. The two you just mentioned, certainly, because both of these independent candidates have sort of made a virtue of the idea that they're going to, if they have any balance of power considerations, they're going to actually negotiate with both parties over which they'll caucus with based on their own sort of centrist agenda. But then there are two other states with Senate races, Louisiana and Georgia, where it's increasingly likely there will be runoffs. Louisiana has what's called a jungle primary, where all the candidates run on general election day, and if nobody gets a majority, there'll be a runoff on December 6th. That's very, very likely. And in Georgia, there's a 50% plus one requirement for general election victories. And there, Michelle Nunn and David Perdue are likely to go to a runoff that'll be on January 6th, 2015. So between those two likely runoffs and the possibility of independents holding out until January to see who they'll caucus with, yeah, it's entirely possible this will go into extreme overtime. But Republicans are hoping to seal it all off on November 4th, making all of those later issues academic.
So if Michelle Nunn doesn't get 50% in Georgia and Mary Landrieu doesn't get 50% in Louisiana, and you've got this lag in Louisiana till December and then till January of 2015 in Georgia, surely if the whole Senate hangs in the balance in that period, then both parties are going to be pouring in huge amounts of money, and national attention will be on these races, won't they?
Yeah, I mean, the conventional wisdom is that these sort of special runoffs favor Republicans for the same reason that midterm elections favor Republicans. Older, whiter, richer voters are more likely to turn out in anything other than a presidential general election. But we've never really seen a scenario like that which could occur this year, where so much rides on these elections. And I might mention that in 2002, Mary Landrieu actually won one of these post-general election runoffs. So there's precedent for a Democrat winning, and what it'll really mean is, an extraordinary holiday season for political consultants and campaign workers who will have some extra fat paychecks going through the holidays this year if the runoffs in those two states matter a lot.
And the poor, afflicted American public who think that an election is over are going to be bombarded with even more advertising and a great deal of panic.
Yeah, that is correct.
So what's the historical reason for this? Is this some vestige of Jim Crow or something in the South here, where you've got this peculiar anomaly of if you don't, you know, having another election after the general?
Well, Louisiana, the jungle primary was actually initiated by Democrats in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I believe, as a way to try to squeeze Republicans off the what amounted to the general election ballot altogether, hoping that two Democrats would be the top two finishers. In Georgia, yeah, it goes way, way back. The majority vote requirement, it didn't really matter until 1966, when the famous segregationist Lester Maddox was actually lifted to the governorship by the General Assembly of Georgia because the candidate who finished ahead of him didn't win a majority. So it's been around a long time, but it's a vestige, but it's not really clear what it's a vestige of anymore. But certainly Republicans have defended these majority vote requirements on the theory that the fewer voters show up, the better the chances they have, which is an unfortunate ideological tenet of the Republican Party today.
So Ed Kilgour, your former boss, U.S. Senator Sam Nunn, his daughter's running in Georgia.
Right.
She's also running away from President Obama. So how does she inspire the minority vote to come out while at the same time, in effect, you know, sort of trying to court the white Republican vote?
Well, I don't know that she's courting the white Republican vote so much as she's trying to keep this from being a strict referendum on what's an unpopular president in a state where Republicans have a natural advantage. But you raise a good point. If it comes to a runoff where turnout is all important, I think she's going to need, you know, a pretty strong partisan appeal. But the reason she's so competitive right now, actually, is she's been running a lot of ads attacking her Republican opponent, David Perdue, for his business record as a CEO who's admitted he was a specialist in outsourcing jobs. So sort of against some expectations, Michelle Nunn's actually running kind of a populist campaign in Georgia right now. And whatever she says about the president, there's a pretty clear effort to differentiate the two candidates ideologically, and it seems to be helping her.
Well, just in closing, Ed Kilgour, you said earlier that there is this Ebola panic may have subsided in 2 weeks' time by November the 4th. Is there any kind of Hail Mary here? Is there any October surprise?
Yeah.
Is there anything that can get the Democratic voters inspired to come out? Because clearly the Republican voters are inspired, if not propelled by irrational fears.
Well, the point is, you know, if you actually cast a ballot, it doesn't really matter whether you're enthusiastic or excited or psyched or motivated. Vote's a vote. And the wild card, potentially, is a, you know, very well-known, very well-financed Democratic turnout operation based on some of the lessons the Obama campaign learned in 2012. Aim very much, very specifically at the kind of voters, young voters, minority voters, who don't usually turn out in midterms. And that's a bit under the radar screen in the sense that it's a little harder to pick up unmotivated, unenthusiastic voters who may still show up in polls. But that's something that Democrats think may tilt the landscape a little bit more in their direction on November the 4th. And I'll give you two particular examples, actually. In Arkansas, African-American voters have had the lowest turnout of any state in the country up until this election. So even a normal turnout pattern among African-Americans in Arkansas will give Mark Pryor a big lift. In Colorado, we're learning that polling Latino voters, who are about 15% of the electorate there, is very, very difficult. So Republicans, even though they're doing pretty well in the polls, are concerned that they don't really know how many Latino voters are going to turn out at the polls, most of whom will support Mark Udall. So that's the big hope for Democrats, that there is an under-the-radar screen turnout operation that will move the results 2 or 3 points, which may be all they need in some of these states.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Ed Kilgour.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ed Kilgour, who's a principal writer for the Washington Monthly's Political Animal blog. He's also the managing editor of The Democratic Strategist, an online forum, and a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute. He was formerly vice president for policy at the Democratic Leadership Council and communications director for U.S. Senator Sam Nunn and a federal state relations staffer for 3 governors of Georgia. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the fear and paranoia about Ebola spreading across the land. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Barry Glasner, who's a professor of sociology at Lewis and Clark University in Oregon. He's the author of several books, including The Gospel of Food, Career Crash, and Drugs in Adolescent Worlds. His award-winning book, The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things, is now in its 10th anniversary paperback edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Barry Glasner.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
And there's a new phenomenon in America known as fearbola. And half of Americans have admitted to pollsters that they believe that they are at risk of contracting Ebola. So what explains this absurdity? It really is an absurdity. There's only two people that have been infected, and one person brought the disease in from West Africa, from Liberia. And yet half of the people in America think that they're at risk of contacting Ebola. So how do you explain this disconnect between fear and reality?
Well, Americans live in one of the safest times in human history, and yet large numbers of Americans are afraid of one thing after another. And what I've looked at is how that comes about and how it changes. And in this case, it follows pretty predictable patterns. So a couple of things happen. One is that there's just constant repetition of the scare from several sources in the media, especially in the TV news media and cable news, and from politicians who capitalize on it. And I should say there's a third element that often plays in and is playing in a pretty substantial way this time, and that's people and organizations that stand to profit financially from this. So we can talk about how each of those is happening in this case if you want, but it all comes together very nicely around this. And in each case, there's also a couple of other elements, or almost in every case. There's the fearmongers are tapping into what I call America's moral insecurities, which range from racial matters and all the way to insecurities about income and inequality, to matters of immigration, particularly in some parts of the country and some parts of the population for that list. For others, it's insecurity about caring for others or caring for oneself. So I think all of that runs through this one in a big way. And so it's a little bit disconcerting, or more than a little bit, but not really surprising, it seems to me.
Well, of course, it is an election season, and there's no question that there's a conflation going on in the Senate races, in particular, Scott Brown in New Hampshire and Tom Cotton in Arkansas, who are conflating Ebola with border insecurity and the beheading of the American journalist Foley, which they actually put, which Brown actually put in a commercial. So that's all being ginned up clearly in the political context. But there's also, I think, rather ugly examples of racism, where you've got young children from Rwanda being kicked out of schools in New Jersey, Nigerian students being kicked out of schools in Texas. The fact that there was one African player on a soccer team who was, people on the sideline were screaming Ebola and Ebola at him till he broke down in tears. So that seems to be, I don't know, do these situations bring out the ugly side, the dark side of our society?
I think they do, yes. And I think those are very ugly incidents, and there are others, of course. You know, when I look at it, I try to see, you know, what if we go 30,000 feet and look at what story is this fitting into. And so I see a more continuous sort of connection that goes back a ways. So, you know, in my research, first I was looking in the 80s and the 90s at fear mongering in the U.S. And then for the recent edition of The Culture of Fear, I was looking at how that's changed or not since September 11, 2001. And one thing I found that where I see this Ebola scare as a continuation is that the sort of overarching narrative that fear-mongering fits into changed and in significant ways. And I think that's quite important because it's hard to really imagine or to pull off a major scare like this. You know, you said half of the population believes this in the survey you were talking about. It's hard to pull that off without having something larger to fit it into. So for your older listeners, will remember, you don't have to be that old, I guess, you'll remember the scares in the 80s and the early 90s, which were, you know, mostly about young people, often young people of color. They were about crime, you know, the notion of the super predator and all that sort of thing. And many of the scares then, we could talk about others, look, we're all about the sick society. You know, we're living in a sick society, and that's what's causing all this, you know, teenage pregnancy and so forth. The politicians capitalized on very effectively. After 9/11, that changed somewhat, and I think in important ways. So that after 9/11, the larger narrative is no longer about that. It's no, you know, in the sick society story, you had, you know, the villains were domestic. It was hard to find heroes. You know, the storyline was about the decline of a great civilization, and then suddenly that all got turned on its head after 9/11, and instead, and since then, you know, quite generally, the villains have been from foreign lands. They're mysterious. There usually are no heroes. And there's this kind of pervasive sense, you know, that this can happen at any point. For a long time, that story was a story about, you know, there can be another attack at any time and so forth. I see this, without much of a stretch, I think, as fitting right into that, right? The anti-immigrant story fits right into that as well. And, you know, so this one slips in very nicely to a continuing story. And I say that for a couple of reasons. This, the first one's probably pretty obvious, you know, how we understand where the traction comes. But the other is this too will pass, right? There'll be another big scare that's equally irrational, probably before very long. But it's the continuing story which greatly affects large parts of the U.S. population and much more so other populations. After all, you know, we're talking about travel bans right at a time when those nations actually need help, and travel bans would be very harmful. So, you know, I think it's important to see that larger picture that this fits into.
Again, I'm speaking with Barry Glassner, who's a professor of sociology at the Lewis and Clark College in Oregon. He's the author of several books, including The Gospel of Food, Career Crash, and Drugs in Adolescent Worlds. His award-winning book, The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things, is now in its 10th anniversary paperback edition. And clearly, The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things, is very manifest and obvious today. By the way, in your not far from you at the Portland International Airport, a child was examined because of they thought that the child had Ebola, and it turned out that the child had eaten too much junk food. So
there you go.
Yeah. So, where is the adult supervision going to come from? I'm astounded that nobody in this country, in the press or in the political world, is standing up against this stupidity and this ignorance and this fear-mongering and this irresponsible paranoia that's being generated. You'd think that the Democrats who are likely to lose the Senate and are up for a re-election would, rather than roll over for this insanity, somebody would stand up and be an adult and explain what's really happening and castigate these cynical people who are using fear of Mexicans crossing the border, the Islamic State invading, and Ebola invading, all of which are just insane exaggerations of reality. You'd think that somebody would want to take this on, but I don't detect. Do you detect any pushback here?
Unfortunately, I have to say that in this case, as others, once they get going, these rampant scares, they tend to be bipartisan, and especially in an election period, they're used to gain votes. Some of your listeners will recall how fear of crime has gotten local politicians and state politicians elected for decades. As a lot of people have observed who've done the kind of research I and others have done, that was effective in times when crime rates were decreasing or had been decreasing for a long period. So, you know, this is not unusual. I've been looking for that kind of person or group of politicians as well, and I haven't really found it. I would say that the president and the White House have been better than the rest of the folks on this. I mean, they're certainly opposing the travel ban and have stepped in to say that these scares are blown way out of proportion. I mean, the general answer I would give to your question, though, is that it's come from outside of the political sphere. So there have been medical authorities from the CDC and elsewhere who have countered these scares, pretty much head on and at considerable peril to themselves, you know, in certain cases in terms of the criticism that they had to know would come back. So I think that's been admirable. And then, again, you know, if you turn that around and look at what comes back at them and how that's used, I was struck by Roy Blunt's statement a few days ago, the Republican from Missouri. I'm just quoting him. We could easily find examples from Democrats, but the notion that nobody can trust government, and hence why would you? And this is not a quote, but that's more or less what he said, right? Nobody can trust government and to do what it's supposed to do, and so of course you're going to have these fears. They're reasonable under the circumstances. Something to that effect.
But Barry, that kind of ridiculous remark really invites a response from the Democrats, because it was the Republicans under the sequestration who cut funding for the CDC, and the CDC is receiving about, I think, $700 million less today than it got in 2010. And furthermore, these Republican governors, like the governor of Texas, who have refused to take the Medicare money under Obamacare because they're running for political office and they've got to run against Obamacare as though it's the devil incarnate. And what's happening in Texas is that Governor Perry is just dumping all of these poor people on the emergency services system at hospitals because they simply have no medical coverage, even though the federal government is offering it for free. He's culpable because the emergency people at the hospital in Texas were clearly overworked, and this fellow came in from Liberia, came in as an emergency patient, and they're obviously not trained sufficiently to screen for these things. But you can excuse them, I think, to some extent, because they're so overworked because of the cuts to the refusal to take Medicaid money. So there's two examples of what the Republicans have done to exacerbate this problem, and I don't see anybody using that as pushback against the fact that they're trying to win an election by ginning up paranoia.
Oh, I agree. Nobody is no one's responding, and in fact, Democrats are stepping on into the bandwagon, which is consistently what happens, unfortunately. I think that's absolutely right. And of course, one of the paradox here, at least, is that more Americans now have access to health care when needed in serious situations. It's extremely unlikely that will be Ebola, but you can be sure it will be something at some point. There's reason to be less fearful in many states in that regard, right, going forward. But, yeah, in the places you talked about and others, that's exactly right.
So, unfortunately, there's, correct me if I'm wrong, Barry Glasner, that my understanding is that there are studies that have been done on politics in the U.S. A Canadian psychologist, Stuart McCann, did a study back in 2009, and others have done studies showing that higher levels of national threat correspond with more wins for Republicans. And that pattern apparently also exists in U.S. presidential elections going back to as far as the 18th century. So I guess the big picture here is that fear drives people to the polls for the wrong reasons.
Oh, absolutely. It's a great motivator to provoke voting. There's nothing like it, you know. If you don't vote for me, this horrible thing is going to happen. It goes way, way back. And it's not just in politics. You know, it's also true at the grocery store and the drugstore and elsewhere. I mean, you know, one thing I've been following in the scare is what's happened, you know, which sorts of products are selling. And the data aren't quite in yet, but, you know, for example, I just saw that Clorox sales are up 28%. Lysol, all sorts of disinfectants are way up. And there are a lot of other people and organizations who are selling products as well. You know, protective gear of all sorts is selling much better and very strong, all of which is completely irrational and in many cases counterproductive. You know, one other element of this, by the way, in terms of voting and more broadly civic participation, I've looked at quite a bit of research on voting patterns of various groups under conditions of fear, and the elderly in particular, the more scary TV news and cable news they watch, the less likely they are to go outside and to participate. And you see the same thing in studies of young people, that civic participation goes down. And that, by the way, does not contradict the topic we were just talking about, so meaning that fear is a motivator to get people to go out and vote, but to continue to be involved in the civic sphere, it goes in the other direction.
Well, just in closing, Barry Glasner, it would seem to me that you could make the argument that this national insecurity, this exaggerated paranoia, mm-hmm. the fact that almost half of the population, according to pollsters, believe that they are at risk of contracting Ebola, would indicate to me that this has a national security implication, that it would be very easy for a foreign enemy to destabilize this country into a vortex of insanity with people, you know, crashing into each other on freeway, panicked. The whole country could go mad if there was a real threat. Do you think that's a reasonable supposition? In other words, we're going crazy over an imaginary threat. What would happen if we had a real threat?
Well, I wouldn't put it quite the way you did. You know, that's a little too War of the Worlds-ish for me. But I think you're on the right track, absolutely. The more this kind of fear-mongering goes on about low-level dangers, the more it's in people's minds. So that when something real happens, overreaction can be pretty extreme and hard to control. And also, the institutions that need to do that are often involved in the fear-mongering at these levels, right? So I suspect under those kinds of circumstances, there certainly will be political leadership. There'll be some reasonable people in the media as well and elsewhere who are going to want to calm the population. Well, how do you do that if you've been scaring them with these small ones all along the way? So, yeah, I think that's a danger.
Well, Barry Glasner, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Okay, thanks for inviting me.
Again, I've been speaking with Barry Glasner, who's a professor of sociology at the Lewis and Clark College in Oregon. He is the author of several books, including The Gospel of Food, Career Crash, and Drugs in Adolescent Worlds. His award-winning book, The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things, is now in its 10th anniversary paperback edition. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the release of one of three Americans held captive in North Korea. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sung-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sung-Yoon Lee.
Thank you for having me.
And one of three Americans held in North Korea, Jeffrey Fowle, has been released and flown out of the country on a U.S. military transport plane. What do you make of this? Because lately we've been hearing, of course, that the young leader has somehow dropped off the radar screen. There was speculation that there may be even a coup against him and that he was seen limping. I think he's still limping. Speculation about perhaps he's overweight or has gout. But in general, this does seem to be at least some gesture of conciliation. What do you make of it?
I would say this latest release of one of the three American citizens who have been detained in North Korea over the past several months, and in one case for almost 2 years now, Kenneth Bae, this was coming. That is, North Korea is, from a slightly perverse perspective, but a real one, I think, actually, I would say, a rational actor. Given the cards it's been dealt, surrounded by the world's biggest, richest nations in China, Japan, the U.S., Russia, and South Korea, it has persevered and survived since the end of the Cold War, primarily through military extortion, being a political factor, resorting to provocations, and doing what we would consider outrageous things, like killing off the uncle of the current leader, as we saw last year. However, North Korea does care about its public image, and continuing to hold on to U.S. citizens for an indefinite amount of time brings North Korea no real utilitarian interest, no value. So it's been about 6 months since Mr. Fowle has been detained, and in the past several years, the past 20 years, I would say, since the end of the Cold War, apart from Kenneth Bae, who has been detained for almost 2 years, as I mentioned, usually North Korea has let U.S. civilians go after about 5 or 6 months, and in one case, a Boston man in 2010, 8 months. So I would say this was coming, and this is one tactic by North Korea to come across as conciliatory and put more pressure on the United States to return to negotiations, create the false illusion of reconciliation or progress on denuclearization talks.
So how much has North Korea been affected by the extremely damning report from the UN on its human rights abuses?
Well, again, it does care about its image, and North Korea is unique in so many ways, really just uniquely unique, grammatical impropriety notwithstanding. For instance, it is the only country in world history that has been industrialized, urbanized, and totally literate, despite having such advantages, to suffer a famine as North Korea did in the mid to late 1990s. It does care about what the outside world says about human rights, because that's not only a sore spot for North Korea, extreme human rights violations, but North Korea is the only country in the world today that operates fast gulags, political prisoner concentration camps. And it doesn't like it when outsiders, pesky foreigners like Americans and Europeans, raise that issue. So, yes, it does care about criticism within the UN and elsewhere about its extreme human rights violations. At the same time, I would say North Korea is not really shaken by it. It continues to deny the existence of such gulags. North Korea is unique in the world in that it is the only country that says with a straight face, we have no human rights problems. There is no such thing as political prisoner in our vocabulary. It's a paradise on earth that we've built.
Again, I'm speaking with Sung-Yoon Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. So given that the young leader, Kim Jong-un, has executed his uncle, who was the second most powerful person in the land, I assume that message to the North Korean people was that you know, if the second most powerful guy in the land can be executed and publicly humiliated like this, then you don't have any rights, you know. I mean, was that the signal they were sending?
I would say so. And yes, by our standards and the norms of normal countries, the civilized world, may I even say, what the North Korean leader, only about 30 years old, did last December in violently, dramatically killing off the number two man, his own uncle, seemed irrational, perhaps even crazy. But if we take a leap of imagination and consider the North Korean state not as a normal nation state, a conventional nation state, but rather as a criminal syndicate, like the mob, the mafia, for example, we know that North Korea operates on a state level on the production and sales of drugs, heroin, methamphetamine, and so forth. We know North Korea produces fake, the world's best fake $100 U.S. bills. We know North Korea produces fake, famous American brand cigarettes and sell them abroad widely. We know North Korea operates like, really, a criminal syndicate. So if we imagine North Korea more as the mob, then killing off your relatives, killing off would-be rivals in a vicious way, all seems to sort of make sense. I mean, we don't commend that, we don't accept that, but we can at least comprehend what North Korea is doing. And I would say that is North Korea. It is very different from the rest of the world. And going back to your remark that the North Korean leader has been missing in action for over 40 days until he showed up recently, that is very much within the North Korean mode of operation. There are many precedents for Kim Jong-un, his father, his grandfather. In a democracy, if the leader pulled a vanishing act for 40 days, that would raise eyebrows. But in totalitarian North Korea, the supreme leader is totally free to come and go as he pleases. So it's not an aberration. He was bound to reappear, I would say.
But there has been at least some tacit admission in the North Korean press that the young leader has some health problems, and he's seen limping and walking with a cane. What is it, just that he indulges too much in luxury foods and all of the things that his own people could only dream of?
I would say so, and that kind of sort of perverse discrepancy or that kind of rift between the realities on the ground for the vast majority of the North Korean population. A UN study on food insecurity last year claimed that 84% of North Koreans are suffering from malnourishment, whereas the elites are obviously well-fed. Now, that is not necessarily a liability in the North Korean context. The North Korean people, I would say, on the whole, don't grow indignant in the fact that their leader is so well-nourished while they are not. They assume that the supreme leader is entitled to some kind of gravitas, both physical and figurative, and they don't really complain about the girth of the leader. Now, of course, he probably has some health problems, Kim, but he is only about 30 or 31. I don't foresee any debilitating serious health problems at this point in time.
So some reports indicate that he has gout, which is a sort of disease,
you know,
that very wealthy kind of English squires get from too much good red wine and pheasant.
Protein and fat. And he may very well have that, but as you know, that's not a life-threatening ailment. Quite painful, I'm told, but, you know, he'll survive it. And he did his, pulled his comeback, came back into the public light, sporting a cane. And again, I would say that is not necessarily a sign of weakness. In the Korean, pan-Korean, Confucian mold of the able, caring leader, even if the supreme leader, whether he's the king of the old monarchies or the North Korean leader today, the propaganda machinery builds up the leader as working hard around the clock to raise the living standards of the common man. very much concerned with the concerns of the common man. So despite his physical ailment, the leader showed up carrying a walking stick. That is not a sign of weakness. I think from the North Korean perspective, that is an attempt to portray the leader as terribly committed to the cause of the nation and the everyday lives of the people.
Well, there's some bizarre stories coming out about his grandfather, the founder of North Korea, that he planned to live over 100 years, and obviously something went wrong with it. Have you been following that?
Yes, well, that is also very much in the old traditional cynic Chinese civilization aspirations to live to be so-called 10,000 years, with dramatization, of course. But longevity has always been very much prized in East Asian culture. His grandfather, actually, for a man of his generation, he was born in 1912, he lived a long life. He died in 1994 of a heart attack, natural causes, at the age of 82. So his grandfather lived fairly long, you know, by any standard, especially for the standards of that generation of Koreans. The current leader's father, on the other hand, well, he didn't have a short life, but he lived to be 70 when he died in 2011. He was 70 years old. So we presume Kim Jong-un, who's, again, only in his early 30s to live maybe another 50 years. However, due to the dynamics in the Korean Peninsula, where you have a very wealthy, pleasant, prosperous South Korea versus a very totalitarian, repressive, impoverished North Korea, I have a hard time believing that Kim Jong-un can maintain the system and survive over the next half century.
So my understanding is that the real Achilles heel for this regime is the fact that they use enormous repression, and they keep their people in a propaganda bubble. But the outside world is slowly encroaching. They pick up broadcasts from China. Stuff is sort of sent over in balloons from South Korea, etc. But my understanding is the most insidious thing, as far as the North Korean security people are concerned, is the importation of South Korean soap operas, which are very popular. You know, black market soap operas are very popular in North Korea, and that they give the people a glimpse of life outside this paradise that Kim Jong-un and company keep saying they have, but obviously which they reserve entirely for themselves and the elite.
Right. North Korea is also unique in the modern world in that it is the only country in the world that has never published basic statistics like population figures, like infant mortality, GDP per capita, and so forth. What most other nations of the world regularly, routinely publish. So while you and I and our listeners have lived through the age of the information revolution, we can say that North Koreans have been dogged counter-revolutionaries in insisting on an information blockade against the infiltration of information from the outside world, making an effort that the outside world does not find out basic facts about North Korea. So yes, North Koreans are the most systematically isolated as well as brutalized people on the face of the planet. But as you suggest, there has been more and more information seeping into North Korea over the past 10 years. And today in South Korea, there are close to 27,000 North Korean escapees, defectors who have resettled in the South. And those who have made their way to South Korea over the past decade or so, nearly 50% of them say that they had been exposed to some sort of information about the outside world, whether listening to radio broadcasts from South Korea or from the United States, Voice of America, for example, or, as you say, watching South Korean soap opera, movies, and so forth, listening to South Korean pop songs, in secret, of course, because it's illegal to gain access to such kind of material, and that was an incentive, curiosity about the outside world, the thought of the possibility of living a better life in South Korea. That was a strong incentive for North Koreans to take that great risk and escape their repressive nation. So I think it's incumbent that the United States and South Korea and the democracies of the world vastly increase their efforts, funding and otherwise, to launch sort of an information operation offensive against North Korea, because it's not only the right thing to do, but it can actually save lives.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sung-Yung
Lee. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Sung-Yung Lee, who's a professor of international affairs at the Fletcher School at Tufts University, a National Asia Research Fellow, and an associate in research at the Korea Institute at Harvard University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.